You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
All right, Jesse, welcome back to the studio.
Good to be here.
It's good to see you. You're not too far away, but I don't see you that often.
Yeah, just an hour away, but that's enough, huh?
Yeah. People really like the secluded nature of cities just right outside of Austin.
A little less crazy, yeah.
Yeah, like you were saying, the city's blowing up.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I went to UT for my master's, and gosh, 15 years ago now. And so, you know, seeing the level of change from 15 years ago to now, it's unbelievable.
Yeah. And did you study neuroscience while you're at UT, or was that at Stanford?
Neuroscience was undergrad at USC. And then I couldn't get a job because it was the Great Recession. I had a neuroscience degree and I wanted to get into business. So I couldn't get my foot in the door anywhere. I was like, all right, I'll go get a 1-year business degree. And I came here for their master's of accounting, which was the best idea because it's the foundation of business. You know, it's the language of business. So that has been very helpful to me in my career of just, you know, kind of understanding the number language of business.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that the numbers language revolves around money, which is what we're here to talk about. And we were laughing about it before. It seems like this recent piece that you wrote last week or published last week is the culmination of the different areas of study that you've explored in your life. And so this whole concept of really going back and looking at the divergence of Neanderthals and Homo sapiens, which is us humans, and trying to make the argument that it's not just that we were smarter, more bruteful or whatever. There actually was something that happened neurologically at some point between, was 160,000, 300,000 years ago.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Basically, in Szabo's Shelling Out, he just kind of like tiptoes into this topic of like, maybe money is part of why humans were able to support a population density 10 times greater than Neanderthals. So this is a strange fact of Paleolithic history that, you know, the cave sites in Europe for Neanderthals, you know, they're dated by like sediment layer, and you can see roughly how many were living in a cave. And then, you know, 35,000 years ago, humans come, you know, Homo sapiens come from Africa and just take over in about 5,000 years. Just Neanderthals are gone, and then it's us from that point on. And then suddenly, this population evidence is 10 times greater. But it's the same land, so how is that possible? And Szabo just tiptoes into that. Maybe money was a part of it. And that has been kind of rattling around in my head ever since I went down the Bitcoin rabbit hole 5-6 years ago. And I talked about it on Preston's podcast in 2021 of like, maybe money is a part of why we were able to thrive. And basically, I've been working on this idea for 4 years, and then I finally sat down and did the heavy research a few months ago, and it all kind of came together, and all these pieces of my life became relevant, which I wasn't expecting. And I was frankly pretty surprised and thrilled at what I found, and kind of I find myself breaking new ground in like intellectual academic discourse, which was quite a surprise, and pretty excited about that.
Yeah. And so let's set the stage. What has you really, throughout the piece, you're sort of prodding at the study of anthropology or the popular understandings that anthropologists put out there about why there was this divergence between Neanderthals and Homo sapiens. Why don't we start there? What is the mainstream anthropology reason for why Homo sapiens inevitably won out the race against Neanderthals.
Yeah, so we first found Neanderthals mid-19th century. And so from that point on, we needed a reason for, like, why did we outcompete them? And back then, the answer was, well, we must have been, like, more evolved. We must have been better, smarter, something, you know, very Victorian thought. And then over the last 100 years, it's kind of been the mainstream understanding of Neanderthals as these, like, brutes, dumb brutes, that we were better than. And as we've learned more, especially over the last couple decades, we've figured out that, no, actually, the Neanderthals were pretty sophisticated. They actually had slightly bigger brains than us. Their tools were just as sophisticated as humans, you know, and technically they were humans also, but, you know, colloquially we refer to ourselves as humans, so we'll go with that. And so, you know, the list of theories over time of, like, maybe we had better brains, bigger brains. Nope, that's not true. Better tools. Nope, that's not true. We were capable of symbolic thought. It turns out the Neanderthals were also doing various gestures of symbolic thought, ranging from having ornamentation and jewelry to there's one cool anecdote of perhaps there's a bunch of flower pollen at a Neanderthal gravesite, like right on top of the bones. So the theory is that maybe they were buried with flowers, which is, you know, a symbolic thought and very humanizing sort of notion for Neanderthals. So, and then the most recent sort of new theory as to why humanity outcompeted Neanderthals baffled me, and it was kind of stupid in my opinion. And this is from Oxford PhDs a few years ago, that that humanity, our subspecies, is generalist specialists, is the phrase they used. And basically they're saying that because we succeeded everywhere, that's why we succeeded. And obviously that's pretty circular logic. And I think doesn't provide any root cause for why we did well. Why, you know, why are we here and all other early human subspecies, of which there were like a dozen in the last million years, why are they all gone? And why did we just take over in the last 40,000 years in particular? And so then pulling on the threads of monetary history and then discovering something recent in neuroscience, and then tying that back into Bitcoin sort of helped to anchor me to a new answer in the piece that it's what I fully explore.
Yeah, and this is where it ties back to Zabo, because shells come into play.
Yes. Yeah. So Zabo, if you haven't read Shelling Out, it's seminal. And I think on my Bitcoin journey, it helped cement, like, Bitcoin's place in money, in terms of just wrapping my head around what makes, you know, what is money. It's really kind of a nice answer to what is money, because it explores how humanity landed on commodity money, first in the form of shells and then later in other forms of commodities or collectibles. But he does such a good and rigorous job of exploring all these different examples and use cases for money too, like, you know, starvation insurance, or, you know, like if you're in a pickle and you need to get accepted into a new tribe or something like that, and you've got some nice shell necklaces on, maybe that's how you get in, right? Like, you can transfer this wealth, because it's hard to come by shells. And I think that's the core idea with shell money that Zabo did such a good job of exploring, is if you can think of living in a world of sticks and stones, and then you see somebody wearing a necklace of beautiful, perfect little shells, that's special. That's something different, right? And you're going to value that, and you're going to want that. And so I think, you know, that's the basis of money, is coveting a collectible item that's rare, that's scarce. And so Zappa does a great job of kind of laying that groundwork and showing that this is what money is, basically. It's an intersubjective value commodity, meaning it's something that we all recognize has value because we know that other people value it. And how do you bootstrap that process? If you logically think through the intersubjective value developing out of nothingness, it has to start with like something scarce that's special that you can decide is something you want.
Yeah. It's funny because this subject of the break between Neanderthals and Homo sapiens sapiens has been discussed. I mean, growing up and learning about the evolution of humans from Neanderthals to where we are today, it's discussed, but this whole concept of money being a tool is never really explored. That really led to the money being the tool that led to the separation, enabled Homo sapiens sapiens to succeed against Neanderthals and other subspecies, is never brought up. And it's funny, in your piece, you highlight like anthropologists, even today, they'll look at glass beads and the necklaces and say that was just a social signal that the Homo sapiens sapiens of the time wanted to portray that they were somewhat respectable to other tribes.
Yeah. Yeah, there's this hang up I found bemusing and slash irritating as I was digging through all these, I guess some context here of when Szabo put out Shelling Out in 2002, the oldest evidence we had of shell money, meaning really, you know, a bunch of the same shells with holes drilled through them, which is evidence that they were strung up, you know, as a necklace or a bracelet or something, in a cave site, buried in the sediment. The oldest example we had of that was from South Africa that dated to 75,000 years ago. In the last 20 years, we found a whole bunch more that are older than that. And as of now, as of 2021, the oldest we found is 142,000 years old in Morocco. And so we just doubled our understanding in 20 years, our understanding of how long humans have been making collectible jewelry, ostensibly for use as a proto money, as a store of value asset that you can transfer in certain life events, with all of these discoveries over the last 20 years, all of the press releases talk about how like it's amazing that humans have always wanted to look good, you know, or like jewelry has been a part of us since the very beginning because we like fashion, and totally missing that there's like an economic purpose that much better explains why we would do this behavior of collecting and making shell jewelry over 100,000 plus year time frame. Of course it makes more sense that this had like an economic function, served as a proto money rather than us just wanting to look good and, you know, express our identity, which is the sort of prevailing orthodoxy of anthropology these days, that like everything has to be understood in terms of self-expression rather than like economic purpose, which I think makes a lot more sense.
Yeah. It's funny that we're talking about this today. I'm not sure if you've been following on X, the big trend on TikTok right now is Chinese manufacturers basically highlighting that all the luxury brands like Louis Vuitton and Prada, whatever it may be, like they're showing like how stuff is actually made in the factories and the fact that it's like actually dirt cheap. And the point I'm trying to make is there may be some sort of social signaling involved, but it is to typically when it comes to luxury goods or jewelry, whatever it may be, to show how much wealth you have to a certain extent, or to say, hey, I'm in this elite level of society where I can wear Prada, I can wear Louis Vuitton. It's sort of like an external
signaling
of wealth that was accumulated.
Yeah.
It's not just to look good.
Yeah, right. And those things overlap too, for sure. Like fashion and a statement of prosperity, they overlap naturally. And there's, great examples of like a huge portion of the world's gold is, lives on the arms of women in India, or on our rings, wedding bands. And so, you know, there is a lot of overlap of like, we like precious things to be part of, you know, our appearance, but it doesn't really explain like, you know, why this behavior would happen everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Unless there's like a, like an existential, like value to, if you manage to make hay while you can, you know, and make some shell necklaces, they might save your life, you know, when you're in a pinch down the road.
What's up, freaks? Do you have a credit card? Are you getting cash back or airline points or points for some other service? Guess what? Those are shit coins. You want to be stacking Bitcoin. And I have some groundbreaking news for you. The team at Fold has finally released the Bitcoin Rewards credit card. They have a wait list. I'm going to be distributing the cards later this year. So you want to get on the wait list. Fold Plus members are going to get unlimited 2% Bitcoin back on this credit card. If you get on the wait list, they're up to $200,000 in prizes they're going to be given out. So get on it as quickly as possible. Go to tftc.io/fold and get on the wait list there. If you're on the wait list, you have the potential to win some of the prizes. Check it out. Sup, freaks? This rip of TFTC was brought to you by our good friends at CoinKite. They make the Cold Card Q, my favorite hardware wallet, the most secure hardware wallet on the market. As you can see, it's got the BlackBerry form factor, full keyboard. It's got two secure enclaves. You create your private public keys offline. The device never has to go online, never does go online. So you keep your Bitcoin secure. If you have your Bitcoin on exchanges and you're looking to get it off, secure it in the best way possible. Pick up a Cold Card Q. Go to coinkite.com, find the Cold Card Q. Use the code TFTC for 5% off. If you're a power user of Bitcoin, like I am, if you're running a business on a Bitcoin standard, if you're just a Bitcoiner who wants to secure your Bitcoin, get the most secure hardware wallet on the market, go get the Cold Card Q. It's a beautiful thing.
What you've really honed in on is that there's a key neurological component that may have led to this divergence, which is the emergence of this TKTL1.
Nice, yes.
Nucleotide.
Yeah, it's a gene. It's serendipitous how, you know, I was doing this research in the last 4 or 6 months, and a lot of these discoveries were made in the last 5 years. So 2022, a paper was put out that it showed that that Homo sapiens have a different TKTL1 gene versus Neanderthals and other archaic humans and apes. They have a different version of it. And so they did some really clever laboratory testing to show what happens, like, if you have this gene versus that gene, what's the difference? And basically, our version of the gene stimulates neurogenesis in the frontal lobe on the outermost layers of the brain. And to a greater degree than the other version, the archaic TKTL1, which is to say that it's in our DNA to have like a more stimulated development of brain circuitry in the frontal lobe on the outermost layers of the brain. And that's as far as that paper goes, right? It's just, they don't even actually specify so much like, well, they do talk about where it's located, but they don't specify like what that circuitry does. They just kind of leave it there. And it's an interesting difference between Neanderthal DNA and Homo sapiens DNA. And it comes back to a single nucleotide point mutation, which is how that would have, that change would have happened. And then you can deduce when it must have happened. Since Neanderthals didn't have it, no other archaic humans had it, it must have happened after Homo sapiens had emerged. But since all living humans have this version of the TKTL1, HTKTL1, that means that it must have happened before a genetic bottleneck. When the last genetic bottleneck was 160,000 years ago, when quote unquote mitochondrial Eve lived, when and we are all descendant from mitochondrial Eve, and which means that like everyone alive came from, ultimately came from her womb, you know, he's traced back to one single individual. So basically she most likely had it. It's possible there's other variations of the math where you could have had it outside of that time range, but most likely it happened between mitochondrial Eve and the emergence of Homo sapiens sapiens. So 160 to 300,000 years ago.
Yeah. And the consequence of the production of the HTK-TL1 in Homo sapiens sapiens and the activity that it spurred in the frontal cortex made us predisposed to find scarce things valuable.
Yeah, that's kind of my conclusion. That's the hypothesis I'm putting out there. And I think it's a hypothesis that fits a lot of these unexplained facts about humanity and our development. But that's kind of the leap that I'm taking here, is saying that based on my neuroscience background, I studied neuroscience in undergrad. I was aware of there's kind of unusual brain circuitry in these specific areas, in the frontal lobe, super granular layers, meaning close to the surface. There's pyramidal, however you pronounce it, variations, neurons, and association cortices, which are strange, sort of processing centers in the prefrontal cortex in particular. And they basically take information from various domains in the brain and kind of bring it all together and synthesize it into abstract thought. That's what these regions do. And so if there's a mutation that happened in our DNA that causes the greater neurogenesis to happen in those specific regions where this kind of processing is going on, that would mean that we have a greater capacity for abstract thinking because we've overdeveloped the circuitry in that area versus Neanderthals and apes and other archaic humans. So my leap there is that our greater capacity for abstract thinking might be what explains why Neanderthals didn't seem to collect shells and make shell necklaces. They just didn't. There's one example of that happening in Spain from 115,000 years ago, which is pretty cool that they did ever engage in this behavior. But they didn't seem to have the drive to do it. So I sort of characterize it as a dim interest to engage in this behavior.
And this is the handprint on the cave wall.
So that's a separate example. So Neanderthals, 20 years ago, our understanding of them was that they didn't really do art and they didn't have any shell necklaces or collectibles. And in the last 20 years, we found a few examples of each, like literally one example of the shell necklaces. They collected fossils, they collected quartz, and then literally last year, they dated a handprint in a cave in Spain, and it was 66,000 years old, which means it had to have been a Neanderthal hand. And we didn't think that they were engaging in cave art, but they were.
And that was because Homo sapiens hadn't traveled north from Africa to Europe yet at that point.
That's right. Yeah. So we arrive 40,000 years ago and 45,000 years ago, and this happened 20,000 years before our arrival. So it was Neanderthals doing art, and so they were capable of it. They were capable of art. They were capable of realizing that that shells were special and then turning them into a necklace. Like, they were able to do that, but they didn't seem to want to do it much. And that ties into my hypothesis of if our brains had a more developed circuitry for this type of abstract thinking, that could have supercharged our drive to engage in those behaviors versus Neanderthals who had the capacity, but a dim interest in doing so. And so, you know, that kind of nicely explains Neanderthals had the capacity for art, for shell necklaces. They didn't really care to do it much, but then we come along and we have this drive to do it. And so we engage in it a lot. And I think the key there is that because we had this huge drive to get shell necklaces, it shows we had a, you know, because of this overdeveloped circuitry in our brain, we had a greater appreciation for scarce assets, basically for things that were rare and precious versus Neanderthals. And I think that to develop the concept of money, which, you know, I get into Austrian econ and the origins of money in particular, to develop the concept of money, you need like a critical mass of people in a group coveting a commodity, you know, who have the capacity to recognize it as special and want it such that you can get, you know, okay, this thing is, everybody values it. And then the rest of the group recognizes that, you know, there's a group of collectors who want that asset. And then everybody else starts to value it because there's market value for that asset. You know, if you find a really nice shell, you can sell it to that weirdo over there because he wants it. So now a shell has value. You need a critical mass of that kind of thinking and covetous behavior in order to kickstart that cycle of a commodity turning into a collectible, which then can turn into a store of value asset, and then it becomes money.
Yeah. And that inability to think abstractly in the case of the Neanderthals sort of limited them. And I think my assumption is that your hypothesis is that the increased in abstract thinking that was enabled by this gene mutation that happened allowed humanity to scale, and mainly because you can get beyond Dunbar's number, which is probably something we should touch on now, is this concept of Dunbar's number, which obviously Homo sapiens living over 100,000 years ago or tens of thousands of years ago weren't aware of Dunbar and his research that was done in our lifetimes. But there are these sort of, I guess, social limits that exist naturally due to our ability to store information and associate information with other individuals in our brain. And you need to think abstractly to scale society.
Yeah, totally. Dunbar's number, everybody, it's gone mainstream enough that people are probably like familiar with it, that, oh, we're only supposed to live in groups of 150 is kind of like the mainstream awareness of it. So that was like a seminal paper, 1992, kind of launched branches of like evolutionary psychology and study of primate behavior. It was really simple. I mean, what he was able to do back then was limited with technology. So what he did was measure the prefrontal cortex, the neocortex volume of primates. And then he plotted that on a chart against how many individuals lived in the group that animal was a specimen of. And so you see like smaller brained primates live in smaller groups, and then larger brained primates are able to live in larger groups. And he did a linear regression of, okay, so what's the line of best fit? And pretty strong correlation. I think it was like R squared of like 0.7, which is really good. And then using that line of best fit, he was able to say, okay, based on our neocortex volume, humans should therefore live in a group of, you know, be able to live in a group of 147, and he rounded to 150. And that's pretty true. You know, like there's a lot of examples in our culture currently and historically of 150 people is pretty much what you can, what's a natural feel, right? For how many people you can maintain stable relationships with as conclusion. You know, like I went to a school that was a small high school. There were 83 people in my graduating class. And so you kind of knew some people in the grade above and the grade below. I probably knew 150 people, you know, it was like a very natural feel. And then I went to a really big university and it was overwhelming. It was good in the 150 context. Military units are 150 often. So, you know, there's a lot of examples of this in our world. And the problem is that it doesn't explain how is it that we do live in groups that are larger than 150. So the next year, in 1993, Dunbar put out a follow-up paper that added language as like a what I call an efficiency multiplier for how humans are able to live in groups of 150 without spending 42% of the day is the implication, without having to spend 42% of the day in one-on-one socializing. This is based on his inferences of, you know, primate behavior. They groom each other. It's like it's one-on-one socializing, social grooming, where they, you know, they groom their fur. And then they go, you know, reciprocate, and that's how they bond in a primate social context. And obviously, we do things differently, but we gossip, right? We chat, we catch up, and that's allows you to cover more ground and form bonds faster than if you were having to like one-on-one groom each other. So that's how Dunbar got around the problem of like, well, if we live with 150 people and we have to, you know, engage in one-on-one grooming with 150 people, it's going to take half the day. But, you know, with language, you don't need that. You can gossip and bond in a much more efficient way. The problem is then that it still doesn't explain how do we live in groups of larger than 150, which we do. You know, now we're in a city with, I don't even know, millions of people. How do we do that? How have we adapted to that? And that's where this the concept of money comes in as an additional efficiency multiplier that allows us to live in groups larger than Dunbar's number because of what it enables, and we can get into that. But
yeah, it's the thing about my high school too. I graduated with 250. Kids in my class, and it was fun. I was having a conversation with one of my high school buddies who was actually in town a few weeks ago, and the night before I had a dream of like two twins that were in her class, and I literally hadn't thought of them since maybe like the early years of college. And I was like, do you remember like Tim and I forget his brother's name, but remember the twins? And he was having problems remembering their names. It was like an example of the limits of Dunbar's number, where yeah. In that small group, we spent 4 years together at an all guys high school where like, we were at school from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. typically every day. And half a generation later, I like can't even fully remember their names.
Right. Just a few too many people for you to deeply know. And then you replace them with other people in the years since. Yeah. And then so, you know, Dunbar's number is just a linear regression of like, of how much brain volume do you have that can keep track of all this information on relationships, and you know it fits pretty nicely for a tribal existence in particular. So, you know, Dunbar's number really is, you know, 150. That's a tribe. Like if you're living in a group 150 or less, you're living in a tribe, and that's very natural. I think there's some appeal to that too. Like I think that's part of why it's known in mainstream cultures. We really are evolved to live in a tribal existence, you know, where you have your whole family and you know, everybody helps raise the kids, and you know that's very natural and organic to us. But Dunbar never really, in my opinion, addressed or explained how is it that we do all right in a much larger social group context? And I think the answer is money, this sort of proto money and what it enables. And then that sort of fits in so nicely with, you know, the other, the fact about TKTL1 and then the, you know, the anecdotes about Neanderthals' behavior versus human behavior, and it all ties it together.
The new administration is pushing hard for government efficiency, but can Elon Musk and Doge fix the dollar? On April 16th, PhD economist Peter St. Ange explains why Bitcoin is the most important tool for government efficiency and how the principles underlying the global shift towards sound money can help you protect and grow your generational wealth. Register now at unchained.com/RHR. That's unchained.com/RHR.
Let's jump into how money enables us to scale beyond Dunbar's number.
Yeah. So there's two main benefits. So Szabo kind of touches on both of them, doesn't really explore them that deeply, but the first is that, and Szabo doesn't connect it to Dunbar's number at all, but the first is that if you're living in a pre-money existence, you're basically living in a barter and favors kind of existence, right? Where it's like you might have something and you know, you want to trade, great. Or you might do somebody a favor and then you expect that favor to be repaid in the future, but you don't have writing and you don't have any way to keep a record of like what was transacted. So how do you manage that? And the way you manage it is by having the rest of the group help enforce what happened, you know, like, oh, okay, yeah, Marty owes Jesse a favor. That's known, and then everybody can like enforce that. And if Marty tries to you know, renege on that, then Marty gets punished by the group. And that's like a very natural sort of human behavior, right? Like you can see that happening.
It's like honor culture driven.
Yeah, yeah, and it's a very sustainable way to maintain social order. And that's all in our brains, right? And that's what I end up doing in the piece is sort of suggesting that Dunbar's number might actually capture the limit of how many people we can have in a group and maintain, you know, a group level understanding of who owes what to who. Right, so I describe it as like mental ledgers of debts. And if there's 150 people in a group, there's 11,000 something, some change, combinations of counterparties. So like Marty and Jesse's one, and there's, you know, 11,000 other pairs. And that, you know, you can't keep track of even that. That's pretty hard. So, you know, in my high school context, I've been thinking about this a fair bit of like, you're kind of aware of people's relationships with other individuals. You know, you have like a rough understanding of like, okay, maybe they have a feud or something and you know why, and you can keep a very basic high level record of interpersonal relationships and who owes who roughly. So that's in the pre-money context. Then if you have the concept of money, basically that goes away, where you no longer are transacting in mental ledgers of debt. And instead you're transacting in the moment with like, okay, I saved your life. Now you can give me your bracelet, you know? And okay, our debt is settled right here, right now. Or, you know, like, oh, you want this nice axe that I have. Well, I like your bracelet and let's trade. Now we've facilitated a barter situation because you have a form of money that, you know, that it's not that I want the bracelet. It's that I want the value that I know that bracelet represents to everybody in the group, and I can trade that bracelet for some other good in the future. So that's the way in which a proto money just removes the cap on how many economic counterparties you can keep track of. You no longer need the group to help police who owes what to who. Instead, you can have the money take care of that in the moment. So that's the first part of it. And then the second part, the second probably bigger advantage, is that in a pre-money context, a tribe would have generally very antagonistic relationships with other tribes, because you don't have a medium for constructive dialogue with another tribe. All you have is violence, right? So all you have is grudges and blood feuds between, you know, your group, your tribe, and tribe in the valley next door. But if you have the concept of money, you have this new transactional medium to enable positive, constructive relationships between tribes, where you can start to have alliances. Basically, you can say, you know, hey, like, we're the big tribe in this area. If you pay us tribute, we'll be allies, and our combined force will be, you know, we'll be able to protect both tribes better. And that's very valuable, right? Like, that's a winning strategy. And so you would start to have those relationships, and having those relationships then fosters tribes living closer together, because you don't need to keep a buffer between you and the tribe next door because, you know, they killed your cousin and you want that, you know, major distance between you. Now you can start living closer together and, you know, engaging in trade because you have a money that facilitates trade. It's not that, you know, with barter you can't trade, but with money it's easier to trade. And that is rudimentary capitalism, really. It's like being able to exchange goods and services for a money is essential. So now you're living in a paradigm where it's possible to have positive, constructive intertribal relationships, where there's an advantage to tribes starting to live closer together. And that explains the 10 times greater population density that Homo sapiens sapiens achieved over Neanderthals when they took over Neanderthal areas in Europe.
Yeah. So essentially, by solving the money problem, the double coincidence of one, once problem, tribe in the valley, hey, you guys have blueberries, we have lumber.
Mm-hmm.
You're pretty well stocked on your wood supply to light your fires, so you don't need our lumber, but we have this money. We need the blueberries. We'll give you that. It's like, okay, you start these small little economic interactions. It's like, hey, we're stronger together.
Yeah.
We're more comfortable. Let's move closer, build a bigger city, and then go out. And so this was happening to Homo sapiens sapiens while Neanderthals weren't developing this abstract thinking to exactly solve this problem. And the power of the coordination mechanism of money allowed literal physical kinetic energy to sort of aggregate to the point where a Neanderthal force coming up against an economic force, if you will.
Yeah.
And Homo sapiens sapiens never stood a chance.
Exactly. You can sort of conceive of the, you know, a scenario where there would be a Neanderthal tribal group living in one valley, and they would be living in this moneyless paradigm where, like, they're very separate from other Neanderthal tribes. They don't have, you know, they don't have alliances. It's just them. And then here comes a Homo sapiens sapiens group. They set up shop in the next valley over. And it's not one tribe, it's five, or maybe it's three. And they're living in close proximity. They're in their own tribal units, but they have somehow figured out this coordination of the, you know, multi-tribe populations. And now that group of humans is competing for resources and naturally going to expand, right, into the Neanderthals area, into their turf. Going to start taking, you know, some of that foraging area, or maybe hunt some of their game. But, you know, what are the Neanderthals going to do? They're going to try to hold their turf and stand their ground, but they're outnumbered. You know, they're outnumbered maybe 10 to 1. and that's a losing battle, right? So that sort of mental model can help explain how humans came into Europe. Neanderthals had been living in Europe for 200,000 years. They were like well adjusted and adapted to, you know, the European environment. And then humanity comes in and just completely, you know, displaces them and drives them extinct within 5 to 7,000 years. And so that explains how you could have that steep competitive advantage over Neanderthals. Is it's just a numbers game ultimately. It's that you had this solitary tribal unit going up against like a proto civilization, you know, like a proto kingdom, where they're, you know, who knows who was the top dog calling the shots among multiple tribes, but they were somehow coordinating, you know, who, you know, how these tribes were going to pay tribute to and maintain positive alliances with each other. And then you're going up against that combined force. You're going to lose.
Yeah. All because we've developed the ability to think abstractly.
Right. And that's what I try in the piece to highlight how strange it would be, because this competitive advantage is rooted in like a weird behavioral quirk. Like, we had a mutation that caused us to covet scarce things. I think that's what amounts to, right? Like, that, you know, Neanderthals didn't covet seashells, and then Homo sapiens covet seashells and collect them and make a whole bunch of jewelry. And in doing so, bootstrap this concept of money, and then having the concept of money allows for constructive intergroup relationships, which, you know, also enables capitalism. And then this weird behavioral quirk of coveting seashells becomes an evolutionary advantage.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the important things to highlight in your hypothesis, is that it wasn't necessarily that humans set out to invent money. It's just like we have this,
yes,
this gene mutation that made us predisposed to covet scarce things. And then eventually at some point, somebody who had that mutation and was coveting scarce things found themselves in a situation where they wanted something, and somebody looked at their scarce things like, you give me that scarce thing and I'll give you this thing that you want. And boom, first transaction.
Yep.
Then naturally things just evolve to, oh, these scarce things should be money.
Yep. And the time scale of it, you know, at the end of the piece, I include like a timeline that I made of going back 300,000 years and then walking all the way through that history of like, where does, you know, there's no money until, at least that we know of, until 142,000 years ago, which is not that long after this mutation might have occurred, if that was 160,000 plus years ago. And then money starts to show up, right? And then we go from just one player in East Africa, you know, this new upstart tribe, to taking over Africa slowly, right? Like, this would be unbelievably slow progress because there's no technology in place or stability in place to help ensure that any sort of breakthroughs are propagated through time. You know, like, you probably had localized breakthroughs of like, oh, it's, you know, let's invent a new form of tribute between two tribes and have a really healthy relationship. That's for
like oral traditions came in and
yeah,
you had to pass things down.
Right. And that was the best you had. Right. You could have had scenarios where some relative genius early human came along and invented some new technology, but you know, maybe pass it on a generation or two and then it's lost, right? Like, there's it's very hard to make lasting gains in a world where you're fighting for your survival in a sort of tribal cave existence without much language, and certainly without any writing or any, you know, any sort of stability that we would call civilization. So, you know, that's the context in which this is slowly evolving, and our behaviors are slowly evolving around, you know, it probably started with some group saying, hey, you know, these shells are awesome. Like, I want more of those. And somewhere, you know, 150,000 years ago, some small tribe developed this concept of money, and it proves some sort of evolutionary advantage, and it, you know, spread from there, because they propagated from there. Like their genes were successful, and I think took over Europe from other archaic early human species, of which there were quite a few living in Africa at the time. Sorry, in Africa in particular. And then the timescale of it is, it's hard to overstate how slow the progress would have been. And I think it's easy for us to jump to like, oh, so they invented money right away and you're off to the races. But I think the reality is it would have been a very slow organic emergence of this predisposition to covet special things to slowly morph into like a proto money. And then that slowly morphs into like an ability to exchange value between tribes. And that slowly turns into alliances and, you know, like the practice of alliances between tribes. And I think that explains the sort of 100,000 years it took for humanity to break out of Africa decisively. And then it was game over for every other early human group living in Europe or in Asia. We just took over within a few thousand years.
Well, then not only that, once that critical tipping point was reached and you had the multi-generation iterative process of coveting scarce things, mm-hmm. realizing that they could become proto-monies, inevitably become a proto-money, but then you look back the last 4,000 to 7,000 years and things have really accelerated.
Yes.
And money itself is something that ironically, people have lost touch with what it should be, but I think that's what we'll get to towards the end of the conversation with Bitcoin. But humanity developed more advanced forms of money over time.
Yes. Yeah. This is something that Szabo does a good job of, and Saifedean does an even better job of sort of showing how through documented human history, so really kind of the last 6,000 years, last 5,000 years, we see a sort of Darwinian monetary battle playing out on a global scale. Saifedean does a great job of showing how when a civilization that used gold came into contact with a civilization that used anything else as money, well, guess what? The civilization that used the money that's harder to make more of ended up essentially confiscating the wealth of the other civilization. Because if you valued, as happened, if you valued glass beads and you know, the Europeans who came into contact with these African tribes that valued glass beads figured that out, they send a message home to Venice, to the glassmakers that have better technology than anybody in Africa to make glass beads. You send the message home, hey, make a bunch of glass beads and send them down on ships, and you know, we'll be able to buy a lot of stuff. And they do that, and the Europeans were able to use these newly created Venetian glass beads to buy up all of the wealth, all of the land, all the assets, all the everything from these Africans who thought that glass beads were money. They thought, you know, oh, I know how hard it is to make a glass bead, and I know that, you know, that's what I want. I want a glass bead because it's harder to make more glass beads than it is to make more seashells. You know?
And that may have been true in West Africa. They were
exactly
just ignorant of the fact that it was not that hard to make somewhere else in the world.
Yes, exactly. And so when gold emerged in the Danube Valley 6,000 years ago, because of the Varna culture's sort of advances in metallurgy, it's kind of the necessary breakthrough for gold to be possible as a refined metal. From that point onwards, we see the pretty rapid takeover of gold as the preferred money for human civilization, wherever that has reached. You know, and so there are examples in more recent history of like islanders in some remote place who had never been contacted by Europeans getting absolutely destroyed. You know, having their wealth confiscated very rapidly, you know, a few hundred years ago. because gold finally reached them. But starting 6,000 years ago, we see the early collectible money being replaced by gold as the hardest, best store of value asset that can be used as a money. And, you know, that's the monetary Darwinism at play, which is just it's not that we've consciously decided we only care about, you know, whatever is the hardest thing to make more of. It's just economics. It's just an economic reality that if it's easy to make more of something, that's not a good place to store your wealth.
Yeah. And so is Bitcoin. I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this. Is Bitcoin essentially the end all be all of scarcity and proto commodity money, in the sense that it is the most scarce thing that will ever exist. And it was introduced to us 16 years ago, and we're just going through the phase of more and more of us recognizing that it is scarce, and many of us recognizing it without the knowledge of this TKTL1 gene mutation that makes us predisposed to covet scarce things.
Yes. That's what's happening. And I think that's what's I had to pinch myself a few times. Like, why am I finding this hypothesis when, you know, anthropology should have found this and put the pieces together between this TKTL1 mutation and the history of money? You know, like, they're kind of asleep at the wheel in that sense. They just missed it because everybody's so narrowly focused on their own world. And most people haven't studied Austrian economics, and certainly not Bitcoin. And so having that additional information it helped me to try to, you know, put this we're all trying to understand Bitcoin. We're all trying to understand, why is Bitcoin so alluring to us? Why are we all drawn so deeply into it? And this hypothesis would suggest that this is the fulfillment of a species-long quest, that we've been looking for a more scarce asset going back to, you know, whenever this mutation happened 160 plus thousand years ago. And, you know, we went through seashells and then other collectible money, and then gold emerged as a more scarce asset that we could use as money. And now, you know, we had the very brief fiat era here that's not scarce at all. And then Bitcoin is invented, and it's the invention of, or discovery of, absolute scarcity. There's a first time in history where there's an asset that has an immutably finite supply, and it's usable as a money. It's usable as a store of value that you can transact with. And I think that, you know, the last 16 years has been, little by little, our species interacting with this technology and slowly recognizing one by one, wait, this is the most scarce asset ever. And I love scarce assets because it's in my DNA to love scarce assets. So I want some of that. You know, and this is huge. This changes everything. This is finally what we've been searching for the entire length of our species. And not only, you know, have we been searching for it for the length of our species, but the attributes of this thing is what made us succeed as a species. Like, recognizing that this is perfect scarcity it's like saying I'm able to understand that this thing is, you know, it's a parallel to why I'm here. Like, you know, Bitcoin is a perfect form of scarcity, and I'm here because I value scarcity. And it's this like coming together of our purpose and our identity. It's really what makes us human, is valuing scarcity. And then here's this thing that is, you know, the instantiation of perfect scarcity, this final fulfillment of what we've been trying to find, a perfect scarce asset for 142,000 years plus. And it's, and we've only just begun on that timescale to incorporate that into our lives and into our society. But here it is.
Yeah. So Bitcoin status as a reserve currency of the world is literally written into our DNA. Or not literally written into our DNA, but we are genetically predisposed. Like Bitcoin success is literally genetically predisposed in our,
yeah,
in our DNA.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, most people don't know anything about Bitcoin, and most people avoid Bitcoin because they don't know anything about it. But people who learn about Bitcoin get drawn in. It's this inescapable gravity of, holy shit, this thing is incredible. It's a perfectly scarce asset, and I covet that, you know, and it's a DNA level fascination that we just can't help but like covet this thing because it's perfect scarcity. And I think that tells the story of like going forward, what's going to happen here is that everybody has this DNA. Everybody has a brain wired in this way. And it's just a matter of people learning enough about Bitcoin for that wiring that covets scarcity to just get lit up and say, holy shit, this is what we've been looking for, even though we didn't know it for 150,000 years.
Yeah. And the ramifications of that collective recognition and ultimate value flow into Bitcoin. You said something a few minutes ago about recognizing that scarce assets can be this proto money, and developing those scarce assets and the money really helped us thrive. And you mentioned we live in this fiat era, which on the grand scheme of the timeline that we're talking about in this conversation is a blip on the radar.
Tiny blip.
And we've talked about it a lot. The manifestation of fiat money, money that can be printed ex nihilo, has had negative externalities on the global economy and the quality of life to some extent for many, many people. And so I think there's an incredibly encouraging and optimistic realization that comes in once we revert back to not only scarce money, but perfectly scarce money.
Yeah, completely agree. The fiat interregnum, as Vijay puts it, is this tiny blip of us going away from our DNA. We've switched to a form of money that is easily printed, and that's only been possible because of, you know, a sleight of hand from government. And the Achilles heel of a physical asset like gold, you know, which allows for that sleight of hand because gold has to be centralized, and then you end up with promissory notes on the gold. This fiat era where we've seen the shitification of everything is against our nature. It's against monetary Darwinism, and it's out of sync with our DNA. And I think that, you know, Bitcoin can and will simply brush that away as the, you know, inevitable incentives of and properties of Bitcoin are more known to people more broadly. And, you know, that's where it's like, it's frustrating to us Bitcoiners of like, why isn't it happening faster? But I'm only 16 years in and, you know, monetary shifts of this nature, you can't expect to have them happen any faster than a few generations at a time.
Yeah. And it also begs a question about the fiat interregnum of how many people are okay with this or completely unaware of this interregnum because they view something like dollars as scarce. And it makes me think of surveys that have been done, simple, like man on the street surveys. And I think if you send a survey out to thousands of people around the country and you asked what's backing the dollar, right, a material percentage of them would say gold.
30%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you do have like a subset of the population that still thinks that the dollar is tethered to a scarce commodity in gold, but it simply isn't. We live in this era where, like I said earlier, people do not understand money, number one, and more importantly, number two, the money that they're actually using, which is being consistently and increasingly debased over time.
Yeah, people have been duped, and the cost of that deception is their lives get worse. You know, everything gets more expensive, and wages don't keep up, and you know, the middle class has been gutted, and everyone's a lot worse off on the whole in the last 100 years in terms of their purchasing power and ability to, you know, afford a decent life. And you know, that kind of deception can't last, right? That's transitory, ironically. And, you know, all of this is this backdrop of this fiat experiment. It has to end because people are smart enough to eventually say no, or more specifically, eventually transition their wealth into other assets. And we've seen that really, you know, the 401k and rental real estate becoming kind of the de facto stores of value for you know, wealthy people in general, is evidence of that. And, you know, and then along comes Bitcoin and has better properties than these other assets. I think part of what is exciting to me about this, you know, puzzle piece of TKTL1 and, you know, the origins of money in humanity is it kind of helps explain what Bitcoin is going to do to the global asset landscape slide. But, you know, that people have probably seen the
very famous Michael Saylor shilling it now.
Yes. Yeah. Which is awesome. So that's my slide that, you know, I there wasn't a good answer anywhere of like, how much money is there in the world? How much value is there in the world? And where is it all sitting? So a few years ago, I went about trying to put a number to it all and did a fair bit of research and some math to come up with, all right, this is kind of roughly where it all sits. And $900 trillion sitting in these different buckets, of which, you know, bonds and real estate are kind of the two biggest ones, like $300 trillion ones. And bonds in particular is a shitty asset, especially going forward.
Right now.
Yes, exactly. And so my mental model of what Bitcoin can do has for years been based around this exercise I went through of like, what's the full potential valuation for Bitcoin? And the starting point for that is like, how much money is there in the world and where does it all sit? And then once you know how much money there is in the world and where it sits, then you can assess, is Bitcoin a better store of value asset than these other categories, these other buckets? And, you know, kind of across the board, the answer is yes, because Bitcoin has perfect scarcity and none of these other assets have that, especially bonds and fiat money, which are, you know, so easily printed. And then the question becomes, okay, so how much capital currently sitting in these various buckets might be interested in migrating, in shifting from these existing buckets and into Bitcoin? And, you know, that exercise led me to I thought conservative full potential valuation for Bitcoin of 200 trillion of the 900 trillion in today's dollars of capital, which would be $10 million per Bitcoin in today's dollars. And Michael Saylor sort of run with that and built on that valuation framework. And he put out his own model, this sort of built on my thinking there. And he came up with, you know, $13 million per Bitcoin in 20 years, in future dollars is his estimation for what Bitcoin will do. And that's the base case. And he's got the bull case of $49 million per Bitcoin in future dollars, which, you know, there's 4x inflation between now and then baked into his assumptions. But anyway, I think, you know, this this sort of puzzle piece that I think I've found here of like helping to understand Bitcoin and, you know, why it is so compelling in the context of human evolution helps explain why capital will flow from these inferior assets in the global asset landscape over the coming decades and into Bitcoin because of its superior properties as an absolutely scarce asset.
Yeah. And that, I can't stop thinking about the timeline of going back, because that's anthropologically funny enough. Like that's something that I just am fascinated by. Like, what is the effect of the fact that we live in the digital age on the speed of adoption of Bitcoin? Mm-hmm. Like the timeline, like we went from 162,000 years ago, this mutation developed in the TKTL1 part of our DNA, then 15,000 years, maybe class B show up, and then you have a whole like tens of thousands of years where you're going through that iterative process of creating a proto money. Then it's okay, you have civilization coalesce around gold, class B gold, but ultimately gold. And that takes another few thousand years. Then Bitcoin shows up 16 years ago, but alongside all of this monetary advancement, we've obviously had technological advancement enabled by that monetary advancement. And most importantly today, as it stands, we're here, lights, camera, mic, internet. Like, what does that do in terms of distilling information broadly to humanity?
Yeah.
To have that sort of like critical tipping point, like how much time is taken out of the process of adoption because we have these communication tools?
Yeah. A ton, I think. Yeah. You know, going from 6,000 years effectively for gold to take over the world, any reasonable number for Bitcoin is incredibly fast compared to that. Like maybe it takes 60 years, right? And then you're talking about 1% of the time it took gold to conquer the world. And yet that would still feel like a long time from our point of view right now, right? Like 44 more years seems like
it's a lot of our scarce time. We only have so much time on this planet.
Right. But like that would be an incredibly fast monetary revolution. And maybe that's what happens, right? Maybe it takes 60 years for us to complete the S curve, but maybe it goes faster. And I don't know the answer. I guess nobody does, but it is interesting to think about in putting together that timeline of human history, I kept thinking about Moore's law, and, you know, that obviously that's a logarithmic curve of computing power, if that's a fair characterization, through time. And that means it's exponential, right? And the progress that you make in the early days of computing is incredibly slow, right? And then now you get massive progress for each incremental year. And I think that's sort of the same thing with, call it, information exchange in humanity, right? That now with the internet is global and instantaneous and very, very rapid versus, you know, in a tribal setting 100,000 years ago, you would be limited to the transfer of ideas, you know, through tribal valleys, right? Like it would take time. So, you know, who knows how much that accelerates this process for us. And then of course, the other thing is that, you know, we're limited by our wetware, our hardware upstairs, of how quickly we can all come around to the realities of Bitcoin relative to every other asset out there. And I think part of that story is, you know, I come back to, like, if you grow up in a world where Bitcoin exists, then Bitcoin's normal. And if you didn't, then Bitcoin's always going to be a little weird to you. And so I think, you know, we might be limited by that ultimately. And that would require like a generation or two for adoption to really happen.
Sort of anchored to the life that we knew before Bitcoin was launched.
Yeah.
I see it. I see it with my 5-year-old, even my 3-year-old now. they both watched the Tuttle Twins. They know what Bitcoin is. My oldest, for chores, he demands Bitcoin.
Nice.
Demands sats for getting chores done. He's always trying to think of competitions that we can do so that he can win more sats.
And that's cool.
I think it's just, you know, it honestly, I've said this before, and it is earnest. I did not push it on. We got a subscription to Angel Studio for the cartoons that they have for Tuttle Twins specifically, and I didn't push him towards the Bitcoin episodes. He was naturally drawn. I'm sure it's because he's heard me and my wife discuss Bitcoin, and he knows that Daddy talks about Bitcoin, and so I think there's probably some Daddy's interested in this. I should be too, but you ask him what Bitcoin is and what money is, and those two Bitcoin episodes they do for Tuttle Twins do a great job of distilling that information to a five-year-old, where he's like, Bitcoin's hard money. It's like, why is it hard money? He's like, because it's hard to make. You can't print more of it.
That's all you need to know. That's amazing.
We may be at the point where at least a subset of Gen Alpha or whatever, I don't know what generation my son would be in, what they're calling it these days, but he's going to know what Bitcoin is his whole life.
Yeah. That you know, in the grand scale, that's all it takes right there, right? Like that will sort of ensure Bitcoin is able to become what we think it can be, if we're right, you know. Yeah. if we're right about its properties and how attractive they are, then that will bear out through that generation.
Yeah. And then you have, I mean, it's so multivariate too, because you have the external sort of forced recognition of what Bitcoin is with what's going on in something like the bond market. Everybody's mm-hmm. been glued to US 10-year treasury yields for the last 2 weeks with the post-liberation day chaos that we've seen in global markets. And I think whether it was intentional or not, the moves that have been made from a global economic policy perspective here in the US is forcing people to really think, like, what are these treasury bonds? Like, why are people so focused on them? Why is some of my 40% of my 401k portfolio in these bonds? And then you have like an acceleration mechanism from some external factor, which is the fact that the US treasury market is not stable right now. It's relatively unstable, which is forcing people to question, like, why does this market even exist in the first place?
Totally. All of that. And then it comes back to, like, you know, I love this little factoid about Michael Saylor's model, that in there he sort of expects like 8 to 9% real asset inflation every year for the next 20 years. And so if you're parked in treasury bonds getting, I don't even know what it's at right now, 4.5%,
4.3 and 4.5 somewhere,
you know, for a 10-year, then you're destroying almost 4% every year in real terms, every year that you hold this asset that you think you're getting a nice yield from, you're actually losing in inflation adjusted terms, because you're not keeping up with that 8 or 9% of real inflation.
Yeah. It's fascinating. I don't want to blow smoke up your ass where it's right across from me, but that when I read the piece, the most interesting sort of breakthrough in human psychology behind Bitcoin is in your piece, or your hypothesis, I guess. We haven't rigorously tested it, got peer reviewed or whatever, but I think it does logically follow that if that mutation did manifest at that point in time and shortly thereafter, the shell necklaces became popular, mm-hmm. and then they became really popular, and then humans beat out Neanderthals.
Right.
It's
with 10x population density. What's going on there?
It that does compute with me. That is a narrative that makes sense and a timeline that makes sense and a progression of monetary technology leading to humans, Homo sapiens sapiens, sort of beating out Neanderthals.
Yep. Yeah. So,
that logic follows.
Yeah. Thank you. I don't think that anthropology will, as a field, will be very welcoming to this new outsider's theory.
You're not an expert.
Not at all. The problem is I have interdisciplinary awareness, you know, and that was what made it possible, I think, for me to come up with this theory when the current leading edge theory in anthropology is that we are generalist specialists, and that doesn't explain much at all.
Yeah, what's the circular logic? We won out just because we were...
So it's this team of Oxford PhDs pointing out that, like, we
succeeded, therefore we won.
We inhabited biomes that were not previously inhabited, which meant we were just so good at living everywhere. And that since we were so good at living everywhere, that's why we live everywhere. Like, that doesn't really explain, you know, why we had an edge over Neanderthals or other humans.
Yeah. Maybe it's because we figured out what money was, enabled the division of labor. Some of the tribe can go hunt bears for fur so that we can live in the cold weather. Others went and gathered firewood so that you could heat the fire.
Yeah. And have multiple tribes coordinating for greater security and force.
Yeah. Insightful stuff, Jesse.
Here's hoping it resonates with people. You know, I wrote it to be very a fun ride. So, you know, recommend to anyone.
It's an easy read too. It doesn't take, it takes like 15 minutes, if that.
Yeah, yeah. When I plugged it in to see how long it would take, spat out 14 minutes. So, you know, I keep it pretty short, and it's a fun ride.
It is. I think we can get a great meme from it. Hyperbitcoinization is predisposed in our DNA.
It's, hell yeah! And also, some people have pointed out that it sort of suggests that altcoiners are Neanderthals for not appreciating absolute scarcity when they see it.
Yeah, they'll come around. They inevitably come around, you know. Yeah. But yeah, they are Neanderthals. You hate to say it. There's a lot of Neanderthals holding on to their ETH bags right now.
Yes, watching it go down.
Let go. Let go. Go check out Once in a Species. Is it onceinaspecies.substack.com?
It's onceinaspecies.com.
.com?
Yeah.
Awesome.
It's, yeah, powered by Substack, but yes.
Hell yeah. Jesse, it's always a pleasure, sir.
Great to be here.
You got to come by more often.
Yeah, I'm not that far.
Yeah. Peace and love, freaks.
Okay.
Freaks, thank you for listening to the show. I hope you liked it. If you did like it, please make sure you subscribe, rate, review the show. It helps us out a lot. And also, if you like these conversations, I've come to realize that many people listen to the podcast. They don't know we have another sort of layer of this media company. We have the newsletter, the Bitcoin Brief. Go to tftc.io. Make sure you subscribe there. A lot of the topics that are discussed on this podcast, I write about 5 days a week in the newsletter. We also have the TFTC Elite tier. If you sign up for that, become a member. We have a private Discord server for the elite freaks out there where we're dropping ad-free versions of this show and having discussions about everything we talk about a day early. Logan wanted me to make sure if you want to get the show a day early, become a TFTC elite member, you will get that. We have our Discord server. Right now it's conversation between myself and TFTC elite tier members, but we're going to expand that. We'll probably do closed Q&As with people in the industry. I may be doing Macro Mondays. So join us. Go to tftc.io. Subscribe. Find the button in the top right corner of the website. Become a TFTC Elite member. Thank you for joining us.
Okay.